One of the things that I've mentioned during the other sessions, too, is how frustrating it is for me to work with young children as I do. I used to be area director for Indian Head Start programs in a 5-state area, so I was very much used to working with preschoolers. And the amazing thing about preschoolers is how wonderfully creative they are, that they can do almost anything, and that they never hesitate when you ask them to do something. But when I start working with adults, adults become all crumpled inside. And one of the other lectures, I was talking about the idea of how we become corrupted by the dirty devices of this world, by teachers and by psychologists and other people who tell you, you don't have talent, you don't have ability, you don't have artistic inclinations, and how that really freezes people up inside. And in looking at Holden, one of the things that I hear sometimes when I come here and do some of these presentations is that some people who are whispering off in the background after this is all over with say, well, they really like what I said, but that I very rarely quote the Bible or quote scripture. And so I quoted one thing from the Bible last night. I'll quote another couple of things to satisfy those people. But also I wanted to quote something from Madeleine L'Engle. And in it, she's looking at the idea of how people respond to commandments from God, or messages from God, information from God. And this is in the first chapter of John's Gospel. Nathanael is given a glimpse of what Jacob saw, or promise of it, and he wasn't qualified to have this kind of vision. He was narrow-minded and unimaginative, and when Philip told him that Jesus of Nazareth was the one they sought, his rather cynical response was, quote, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" unquote. And yet it was to Nathanael that Jesus promised a vision of angels and archangels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. And this whole idea of who's qualified is something I want to talk about today. Because what happens when I ask people to sing, except for Lutherans who sing all the time, you can't stop them. But when you ask people to sing solo, how's that? Or you ask them to paint a picture or do some kind of artwork, their response is often, ultimately, I'm not qualified to do it. That I'm not an artist or I'm not a musician. And so therefore I can't ask this person over here because she's a musician or he's a real artist and I'm not. And this whole idea of what it means to be qualified is something that bothers me a great deal. And so in terms of looking at the Bible, which is this black thing here, I wanted to quote a little bit from it. And first thing I wanted to quote from was from in Exodus, with the whole concept of what goes on with Moses. If you think about what happened to Moses, he had an interesting lifestyle, that he ends up in the desert, and he sees this burning bush, and the burning bush talks to him. And eventually, as you recall the story, he pays a little bit more attention to the burning bush. And the burning bush, who is the voice of God by this time, at first it's kind of like an angel according to the Bible. And I get the image, it's sort of like if you're a big business executive, first you have your secretary call and get in contact with a person. Once you make contact, then you get on the line. And in the Bible it talks about first it's the angel that's in the burning bush until it gets Moses' attention, and then God comes on the line. And God says, what you need to do, Moses, is to free your people and go back to Israel and talk to Egypt and talk to the Pharaoh there. And Moses' response is, this is chapter 4. Then Moses answered, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord will not appear to you. And at that point, the Lord gives him the rod, which turns into the snake. And immediately when that happens, Moses runs away. Moses freaks out, he can't handle it, and is asked to come back and pick up the rod, a snake, at which point it becomes a rod again. And God again exhorts him in the sense of, oh, now do this and go tell the Pharaoh to let your people go. And Moses' response is, but Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either heretofore nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. In other words, each time God asks Moses to do something, the response is not, here I am, God, send me. It's, hey, I'm not qualified. You know, people won't believe me. And then once you give me something that shows that you actually have spoken to me, I'm an old man with a speech impediment. If you read later on in the Bible, by the time Moses and Aaron actually get to the Pharaoh, it mentions that Moses is 80 and Aaron is 83, that these were people past retirement age. Okay? That if you were going to pick the best people to lead people out of Egypt, would you pick an 80-year-old man with a speech impediment? Then the Lord said to him, Who hath made man's mouth? Who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. And then Moses' response after God says this is not, okay, I can deal with this. Moses' response is, Oh my Lord, send, I pray, some other person. And at that point, God gets kind of ticked off. Actually, what it says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, which in contemporary jargon is God gets ticked off. And at that point says, okay, you can take your brother Aaron with you. And if you look in the Bible in terms of who are these people chosen, over and over again, they're not the first line of defense. Okay? They're not the first ones. They're not the brightest and the best. They're 80-year-old people with speech impediments. One of the interesting things when you read these sorts of items in the Bible is how often, if you read the women's responses to God, the women's responses is better off in the sense of, this is really heavy, but okay. Wow, this is really hard to believe, but I'll do it. And the response of the men is often, what are you talking about, me? Are you kidding? No, send somebody else. This next one I want to read to you is from the Gospel according to Luke. And it's in the first chapter. And this is Zechariah. And Zechariah was married during the times of King Herod to a woman who was, and they were both very old and they had never had children. And if you recall, Zechariah is spending some compulsory time in the temple. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, Do not fear, Zechariah, for your prayer is heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you shall have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great before the Lord, and he shall drink no wine nor strong drink. And he shall be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the sons of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. And think about this. If you were suddenly to walk into your lunchroom, and an angel of the Lord was to appear before you and say, You're really in for something terrific. Have I got a deal for you? We're going to give you a son. You have never had a son before. You're old, you're barren, and now we're going to fix all that. It may be late, but it's better than never. And you're going to have all these wonderful things come as a result of that. Do you think Zechariah is all excited and says, That's terrific. I'm so glad that my prayers were answered. I'm so glad that I was the one who was chosen because that means that I'm exalted among all men. Zechariah's response was, How shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years. And the angel answered him, I am Gabriel, who stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. Now, angels seem to have even a less hold on their temper than God does. And so Gabriel's response when Zechariah says, How am I supposed to believe this? I'm an old man, the woman's old too, she's past menopause. The angel answers, Behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things come to pass, because you do not believe in my words, which will be fulfilled in their time. At which point, Zechariah is struck dumb, and he can't speak until later on, if you recall the story, when Mary comes to visit her kinsperson, Elizabeth, the wife of Zechariah. And at that point, when it's proclaimed about the miracle birth, then Zechariah can speak again. And so again, we see the idea of who is being chosen to further the glory of God. Is it the qualified? And it doesn't seem to be the qualified. It doesn't seem to be the one who would be the most logical choice from a human being's point of view to do all these miraculous things. And then finally, the one I want to close with, because this will be three quotes, and in Christianity people seem to really enjoy three, although in Native tradition we seem to pick four a little bit more. The last one I want to read it also from Luke, and this one you may be a little bit more familiar with. Angel Gabriel, who gets around a lot, went into the city of Galilee to a virgin. Did it start ringing a bell? He came to this virgin and said, Hail, O favored one, the Lord is with you. Although there is a footnote here that says other ancient authorities add, blessed are you among women. Footnote. But she was greatly troubled by the sting and considered in her mind what sort of greeting this might be. In other words, especially people who lived during those times realize that when angels come to, it's not always with good news. That sometimes it means that you have to drop all your stuff and do something. It's a major hardship for you. And so she's a little bit worried, and the angel said to her, quote, do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And the next part you know. Okay? So let me jump down a few verses. And Mary said to the angel, how shall this be, since I have no husband? Mary is extremely practical. Mary is not saying no, but she wants a little bit more information. And the angel said to her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. And behold, your kinswoman Elizabeth in her old age has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month with her, who was called barren. For with God nothing will be impossible. Okay, that's a line I want you to remember. With God nothing will be impossible. And Mary's response then is, Mary said, behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. And the angel departed from her. So in other words, Mary didn't say, well, look, can you pick my cousin Sarah? It was, okay, I'll do it. And this is something that's very hard for people to understand who don't work very much in the field of art, who don't work with the idea of creating themselves. That, as I've mentioned during each of the sessions, because you were made in the image of God, and God is a creator, therefore you have to be a creator. Do you think God used lousy tracing paper on you? That if that is the power of God, then that power also resides within you. And you have a right. In fact, I think in some ways you almost have an obligation to work with what it is that you create. And each people have different talents or measures of abilities. And so what is given to you to create may be different from what is your neighbor's ability or talent to create. But you all have it. And this is what I want to remind you with in the Bible. That even though you may not feel that you have that talent or ability, all these people who get called by God also had that same feeling. Also had that same hesitation of, well, it would have been better if you picked my neighbor. That he's the one who's really talented, or she's the one who really has that ability. And one of the suggestions may be that God deliberately chooses people who don't seem to have outwardly the ability or talent or the grace, because when that happens, when you yourself realize how little you probably have, when you do something that is a miracle, that is accomplished, that is wonderful, then you don't take credit for it yourself, that you don't lose your humbleness and become prideful, but you realize it really was the Spirit of God moving through you. There is a book by another friend of mine. I realize I only quote books from friends of mine. I should quote books from people I don't know, too. But Peter S. Beagle, who wrote a book, which is a delightful book, called The Last Unicorn. And The Last Unicorn, in that particular novel, there is a scene where there is a character called Schmendrick, the magician. And Schmendrick is an awful magician. That he's a real fumbler, kind of carnival kind of magician. And he does this because he really does have the talent. He really does have the magic with a capital M, but he can't always get to it. He can't always access it. And every now and then, usually when he doesn't expect it, the magic, capital M magic, will come and flow through him, and he'll do miracles, miraculous things. But since he can't call it up at his command, he has to earn his living by being a sideshow magician, by doing juggling and pulling coins out of people's ears and making artificial flowers appear. And in the book, Schmendrick talks about what it feels like when the true magic comes over him. And he talks about when that happens, the true magician is like a beast of burden, and that you, as a beast of burden, carry your master, the magic. And you don't really have a control in the sense of where it will go or where it will end up, but you just bear it while it sits upon you. And that, to me, is very much what it feels like to be a creative artist. It's something that Madeleine Ingle talks a lot about in her book. It's something that when I've talked to people who are really talented, or to me, who are outstanding in their field, whether they're actors or painters or musicians, that when the magic rides them, when the power of God is within them, they don't really understand what's happening. And basically their job is to get out of the way and to let that power flow through them till something is created. And in that sense, there, when I talk to people who are creative artists, the response is often the same. I didn't know where that came from. I didn't know where those words came from. I didn't know where the music came from. But it came to me as though it were already complete. And that just flowed through me. And I just let it happen. And when you try to make things happen, it's often when you put the block up where that power can't flow through. When you feel like you have no control over it, like Schmendrick, that you try to summon it, but it won't come, because it comes on its own time. And part of being an artist is to be ready for that time when it comes, so that you have the paints ready, or you have the musical notation ready, or you have your audience ready. And you step out of the way and let that power come. Because when it happens, you realize how humble a servant you really are, and what the work that you're doing really is for the glory of God, and not for the glory of yourself. Because for, again, as I said, the people that I've talked to, it's very hard for them to even claim that art piece, because they felt so little a part of participation in it, that it was really something that flowed through them. As a psychologist, when we study certain things, there's a thing called, by some researchers, uptime. And uptime is the idea that when you do some things, particularly some things of a creative nature, for example, weaving, or beading, or knitting, or other things, that you will become so involved with those activities that your state of consciousness will alter, that you will not have your usual waking consciousness, and so you won't be aware of the passage of time. And maybe you've had that experience, that you're so engrossed in something that you were doing in terms of creating something, that you're not really that much aware of what's going on around you, that you are operating in a different set of framework in terms of mental constructs. And that's a very exciting time, a very pleasant time. Often you don't realize you're in the middle of it when that's happening, that you don't realize you're in that frame of mind until after it's taken place, because you're so engrossed or engaged in what it is that you're doing. And that, I'm suggesting to you, is also part of that creativity, that you're not aware in your usual way of being aware. And I think a lot of us spend a great deal of time trying to be aware with a small part of our mind, because it's really frightening to let go. It's really frightening for people, particularly, I think, a religion like a lot of the people who belong to Lutheranism. If you look up at the flags that are flown, the banners that are in the village center, one of those flags, which I assume are virtues to which one should aspire, is self-control. And what we're talking about here in terms of getting out of the way, letting go and let God, so to speak, is not always an issue of self-control. It's sometimes the idea of saying, I'm a beast of burden for the glory of God, and therefore I shouldn't be in control of my own reins. That I can let go of that and let God take possession of those reins and point in the right direction. And if you fight so hard for that self-control, it's really hard to let go and let God. And your intentions, your desires, may not be exactly what God has planned for you. I'm sure Moses would have been really happy to kind of retire in the desert with his sons and his children and watch sheep grow. Okay? Watch goats grow. But that wasn't what God had planned for him. I'm sure there are a lot of others of us for whom it would be nice to just be a very ordinary, simple person, but that may not be God's plan for you. And again, I feel that each one of you has the potential in terms of creation, because each one of you are children of God, that you inherited. And creativity to me is not a recessive gene, the way red hair is. That creativity is a dominant gene, but oftentimes we don't give it the opportunity to express itself. And with that in mind, I want to tell you a story. And a cushy wash-up. Long time ago, long before the coming of the great flood, even before the world turned upside down, in those days the people were animals. But they didn't look like animals we have today. They look more like you, and you, and you, and me. They look more like human people. And it wasn't until much later that someone came called the Duhuibash, the changer. Changed everything, gave everything a purpose and a reason for being. changed the course of rivers, made mountains, gave the animal people the sizes and shapes they wear today, and created human people. Now the old people, when they're translating from Indian language into English, will often translate out Dohoibash as being Christ, as being Jesus, and make a separation in terms of the creator and the Dohoibash, even though on some other levels it's understood they're really the same person. One is a manifestation of the other. And you have this same kind of confusion in terms of trying to figure out exactly who God and the Holy Ghost and the Son are. And we have something of a similar problem in terms of trying to explain how the Creator is different from the Dohoibash. But I'll leave that go because that's not what I want to talk about today. But during this time, there was a young girl. And this young girl was someone in our language that we would call Ayayesh. Now there are some sounds in our Indian languages which you don't have in English. And there's some words that when we say them feel different inside your mouth than English words do. And so I want you, this is called audience participation, to test this word out, to try it out, roll it around in your mouth and feel what it feels like. And the word is Ayayesh. So say that word, Ayayesh.
Ayayesh.
Now isn't that an interesting word? It doesn't feel quite the way a lot of your English words do, does it? Say it again, Ayayesh.
Ayayesh.
Ayayesh means stupid. This girl was what we call Ayayesh. Now day after day and all day long, all this young girl did was sit underneath the cedar tree and watch the world go by. And other kids who were her age, they would help their old people pick berries, but not this little girl who was Ayayesh, just sat underneath that cedar tree day after day and all day long. And other kids who were her age, they'd help their old people tan deer hides. But not this little girl who was Ayayesh, just sat underneath that cedar tree day after day and all day long. And other kids who were her age, they'd help their old people dig roots. But not this little girl who was Ayayesh, just sat underneath that cedar tree. Until finally one day the cedar tree couldn't stand it any longer. And the cedar tree spoke to her. Now in the old days, maybe trees spoke to people a lot more than they do now, or maybe it's just that we don't listen as well as we used to. And that cedar tree told her, you're so Ayayesh. You watch me. I'm going to show you how to do something. And the cedar tree showed her how to take the cool, pale, moist roots of the cedar and coil them around in circles, coiling and sewing circle upon circle, until finally she made the very first basket. Now, as I mentioned to you in one of the first sessions, the circle is a very sacred symbol of the Indian people, that the world turns in a circle. That, as I mentioned before, we say something of importance or pray that we turn in a circle like this to show that we are in harmony with the earth, which turns in a circle. Our medicine drums are often made in circles. The wind, when it moves in its strongest power, moves in a circle. And the old people say, if you look at your fingertips, you'll see the circles there where the Creator blew the breath of life into you. And so this cedar tree taught her how to sew circle upon circle and make the first basket. And now this kind of hardwood cedar basket was very important to Indian people in the Pacific Northwest, because before white people brought Teflon and Tupperware, this is how Indian people, one of the ways in which they would cook their food, that these baskets are so well made that they hold water. And so the Indian people would reach into the fire with tongs, wooden tongs, and take out hot rocks and put them into the baskets filled with water. And that would make the water boil, the heat of the rocks. And the person cooking would have to keep stirring to make sure the rocks wouldn't stay in one place, or they'd burn a hole in the bottom of your basket and you feel really Ayayesh. But this girl was the first one to ever make a basket like this, the very first to create this specific kind of basket. And when she had finished, the cedar tree examined it and told her, you've done a good job, but your basket isn't really finished yet because your basket's naked. It has no designs on it. And the girl started crying, and she said, but I don't know any designs. And the cedar tree said, you're so Ayayesh. You start walking. You keep your eyes open, you keep your ears open, you keep your heart open. And all around you, you'll find all sorts of patterns and designs that you can use. And so it was she started walking. But she was walking and she was crying, and she was crying so hard she wasn't really watching where she was going. And so it was she almost stepped on Wachpush, the rattlesnake. And Rattlesnake said, "What's the matter with you almost stepping on innocent people?" Because rattlesnakes had bad tempers in those days, too. And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, but the cedar tree told me that if I kept walking, I'd find all sorts of designs for my basket, all sorts of patterns, but I haven't found a single one." And Rattlesnake, Bachblush, said, "Ah, you're so ayayesh. You look at me. What do you see?" And she really looked at this rattlesnake for the first time. And she saw that this was a diamondback rattlesnake. And all down the center of his back was a pattern of diamonds. And she said, "Oh, what a beautiful design you are." And the rattlesnake said, "Take it and use it for your basket." And so now she had the very first design for her basket, this rattlesnake pattern. And it's a pattern that we use not only in terms of making baskets to show respect for the power and the wisdom of the snake, but it's also something you'll see in our beadwork designs, in our weavings, in other places besides making baskets. And so now she had her first design, and she was just proud of herself that she had a design. She could make baskets with the rattlesnake patterns. But as she kept walking, she started thinking, "But I can't keep using one design over and over and over again." And so she started crying. And this time someone else heard her. And this someone spoke with a voice like thunder. And this someone said, "Why are you crying, little girl?" And she looked up and she saw that it was Patu the mountain talking to her. And she said, "Oh, I'm crying because all I have is just one pattern for my basket. And Cedar Tree told me if I kept my eyes open, I'd discover all sorts of patterns, all sorts of designs all around me. But all I have is just one." And Patu the mountain said, "Ah, you're so ayayesh. You look at me. What do you see?" And she really looked at the mountain for the first time. And she saw that if you look at a mountain in a certain way, that a mountain is really a triangle. And she said, "Oh, what a beautiful design you are." And Patu the mountain told her, "Then take it and use it for your basket." And so now she had another design. And this design of the mountain is one that you'll see still today being used in the baskets, as in these two miniature baskets, this pattern of the mountain, the triangle. And the internal design of a separate color represents the pathway, the trail that the people take when they go up into the mountains to gather the berries or to gather the materials to make baskets like these. These are indeed the small cedar root baskets that are being described in the story. This size is the kind used by women on necklaces or the kind we give to children to play with. I want you to go a little bit more closely if you haven't had a chance. And so now she had another design. And everywhere she went, other things would talk to her, would share information about their secrets, their patterns, and how they did things. The answer from an Orthodox Native American viewpoint, and that's important for you to realize that all the answers shared so far are correct from a certain point of view. But from an Orthodox Native American viewpoint, the answer is fury. That she stopped being Ayesh when she shared that information with her people. And this is one of the major differences between the way non-Indian people often see the world and the way Indian people do. That for us, knowledge has nothing to do with wisdom. That to garner information has nothing to do with making you wise. There's a Japanese proverb that says, "Learning without wisdom is like a load of books on the back of an ass." That the teaching, one of the teachings of this story is that learning this information doesn't make you wise. The girl stops being Ayesh when she returns home and shares this information with her people. And this is because for Native American people, we don't think of ourselves so much as individuals the way white people do. That we have a tribal consciousness and responsibility to the community, to the tribe, rather than to an individual. And this is part of what this teaching is about, that we tell our children, that even when you go out to college or you try to learn things, what really counts is what you can share with the world around you, not what it does to aggrandize yourself as an individual. Now, if you think again about the Bible, that there are times in the Bible when people had to go out into the wilderness, whether it was Christ or others, to think, to understand what was going on around them. In the traditions of a lot of the Native American tribes, when a person reached a certain age, they had a responsibility to leave their community. For girls, it was the time of the menses when they started. For the boys, some of the tribes said it was a time when a boy's nipples turn out, that these were physical signs that the child was getting ready emotionally or mentally to understand the world in a different way. We have an old saying at my father's reservation that if you spend too much time around your friends, you start to look like them. And if you start to look like them too much, you stop being who you are. And it's not your job on earth to be like other people, it's your job on earth to be who you are, to become all that you were meant to be, rather than a poor carbon copy of somebody else. And so, particularly during the teenage years, the adolescent years, when children so desperately need to bind, to bond, to become a part of a peer group, that's the time when we tell them, go out by yourself, on a vision quest, on a spirit quest, to learn who you are. Not who you are in relationship to your friends, but who you are. Because only by doing so will you really be able to fit to a tribe or a community. And so these children are sent out. They go out to listen, to keep their eyes open, their ears open, their heart open. And this is really part of what the story is talking about, that girl having to be by herself. And the first spirit power, the first guardian angel, if you will, that speaks to her is a cedar tree. Teach her something very special, to teach her something that then she can share with other people. And yet, part of the teaching also with that story is that isn't enough. That just getting the word of God or the glory of God isn't enough. That she needed to do something with it. That she needed to express it in some way. That she needed to take what was given and add something of herself. There's a saying some poets have that when you do work of art, you have to breathe out more than you breathe in. So you add something of yourself to what it is that you've been given. And this is what this girl was doing when she went out and sought these informations from other people, these patterns, these designs. It's important for you to understand again that when we talk about these things, you're talking metaphorically. And this is one of the differences between using English and using our Indian languages. That when we interview medicine people, or when non-Indian people have interviewed medicine people, they get very frustrated because they find a lot of times medicine people or sacred people speak in metaphor, just as Christ did. Christ is a God who told stories. That in that sense, what's going on is that Indian words, these stories, give you a floor in terms of understanding, but they don't give you a ceiling. And one of the things that happens in theology is that so much time is spent in terms of debating the exact precise meaning of a word, what happens is the word is given a ceiling, and unfortunately it's also given four walls. And so the old people back home talk about a lot of times white people treat boxes, words as boxes, that try to capture an idea. And instead, our tradition is the idea that your understanding will be different than mine of something. And so I can't tell you precisely or exactly what it is you should know or understand, but I can provide a floor, a foundation from which you will gain understanding that's appropriate for you at this particular time in life. And you may gain additional information or understanding at a later stage in life, but all I'm supposed to do is offer you the floor, not the ceiling and the sides that go with it, so that you can grow and understand. And that way these stories that we share never grow old, because you're only providing the floor, and with each generation, new understandings are taken and provided. Now, when this girl goes out, she talks to all these different things. In terms of understanding metaphors, on one way of understanding symbols, you do know the difference between sign and symbol, right? Sign is the thing that says, feels like landing 5 miles. It just tells you something. But a symbol does more than that. A symbol does something in terms of awakening something inside yourself, so that again you add something to it in terms of understanding. And these symbols, these butterflies and these other things, are in one way two-dimensional, the way that I draw them, are they three-dimensional the way that they're depicted in these baskets of beadwork that I brought to share with you? And yet, they're more than that. They're metaphors in terms of understanding that these are not just simple symbols, that they're interactions. And that's why a lot of times when I use metaphors in terms of understanding what it means to be in harmony or to be in balance with your life, I don't like to use an image that's a visual image, because a visual image is automatically static, it doesn't change. So that, for example, all cultures, or just all cultures, but many cultures work with the idea of balance, the idea of keeping in tune with oneself and the world around you, and these are often expressed in specific symbols. So that, for example, among some of the Asian groups, we have the symbol of the yin and the yang, which is the idea of balance. Okay? Male, female, light, dark, wet, dry. Within the Jewish tradition, we have the Star of David. And the Star of David represents balance because it's two identical triangles laid on top of each other. Okay? Within the Christian religion, the cross are two lines that balance each other. Within Native American tradition, we have a circle, which also has a cross inside, which is then called the sacred hoop or medicine hoop, again representing this idea of balance. But that's a visual representation, and as such, it's frozen. And because you are living beings, your relationships or your harmonies cannot be frozen, because they're constantly changing in the dance of the world. That other forces are acting on you, so you don't stay in balance if you just freeze. You just tip over. That instead, in order to stay in balance or harmony, you have to constantly change yourself. And in that sense, one of the things that I like to think of you in terms of understanding that as a metaphor is to think about chords. Okay? Musical notes. That those musical notes are in harmony when they're all striking together. And there's a physical interaction that has to do with an element of time. That they sound together over an interval of time, and they change and they blend together to go from individual notes to create a chord. And that's what I really am talking about in terms of maintaining harmony and balance. It isn't like grace where you've achieved it and you don't have to worry about it. That balance is something you have to constantly watch and maintain, because times change. Forces that act on you change too. And what's appropriate for you in terms of how you act at this moment in time may not be as appropriate a month from now or 6 years from now. And I think that some of the things that are found in the Bible. Last night in Vesper service, there was a presentation about how Jesus doesn't come just to bring peace, but he says, I also come with a sword. And this idea that you can't stay exactly the same way all the time. There are times when it will be appropriate to have a sword. There'll be times when it's appropriate to have peace, but not always one thing all the time. Okay? And that's what we're talking about some when we talk about these interactions. How can you be aware of those things around you so that you can act creatively, so you can let the glory of God flow through you to respond to the world around you, not to put you out of harmony, but to put you even more into harmony with the world. Now the other thing that's important for you to realize, and what I've been trying to lead up to during these different sessions during the week, is the story of this little girl. That the lightning, the butterfly, the stars, the gills, the salmon, the tracks of the birds were always there. The circles were always there. The flowers, the markings on the birds and the animal feathers, those were always there, but she didn't look at them. She looked over them. She didn't pay attention to them. And that's why the cedar tree tells when you start walking, you keep your eyes and your ears and your heart open, you discover all sorts of things. These patterns that we've been discussing, these designs, these symbols, really have relatively little to do with what we put on our beadwork, our basketry, or our weavings. What they really are understanding different ways in which you react with the world, in which you dance the dance of harmony. There are times when you need the teaching of the sand. There are times when you need the teaching of the butterfly, the teaching of the mouse, the teaching of the buffalo. That all these ways are different ways of understanding and interacting with the world. And what we put down in our beadwork or our designs are only symbols to remind us of what those interactions are. So we can alter what we're doing to match instead what the world wants us to do. To keep in harmony. Now, the other day, I told you a story about Coyote's eyes. I told you a story about how Coyote lost his eyes and received the eyes of other animal people. He received the eyes of the mouse, he received the eye of the buffalo. I want to talk a little bit about what that really meant, okay, in terms of understanding patterns. That if you go back to the serpent, the first set of eyes that Coyote received was the eye of the mouse. And Coyote discovered that looking through this mouse eye hardly let in any light at all. It was like looking through a tiny little hole, and he could just barely see the things around him with his mouse eye because it was so small. That mice are only about 3 inches high when they stand up on their hind legs, and so they can't see very much of the world around them. That a mouse is concerned with the small common things of everyday living, of where to get the next meal, of shelter, of taking care of its family. And that's neither good nor bad. It just is. But there are some positive things and negative things, or useful and non-useful things about seeing with the eyes of a mouse if you're a human being. That if that's the only way that you have of understanding the world, if it's the only pattern, remember that's what the little girl talked about in the story, that I can't keep using one pattern over and over again. To only see with the eye of the mouse means that you only see those things immediately around you. You don't see the larger picture of the world. That you're so concerned with the small everyday things of living, of getting food on the table, of taking care of your family, of getting your shelter fixed the way that you want it, that you don't see very much of the real world around you. There are times when it's useful to see with the eye of the mouse. When as a human being you really do have to pay attention to small, common, everyday things of living. Of getting food on your table, of getting your job done, of making sure your house is in order. But that would be a terrible tragedy if that's the only set of eyes you have to see with. In some of our other stories, we have the eagle. And seeing with the eyes of an eagle is very important. Our old people say, if you're really sad, if you're really depressed, you should see with the eyes of an eagle, you should be an eagle. And what they're saying is that if you have a tremendous problem, that problem is so overwhelming, so overpowering for you, that you won't be able to see how to go above it, how to go over it, how to get around it, because it's so close to you. And so the old people say, be an eagle. And what they're saying is emotionally detach yourself far enough away from the problem. Because if you become far enough away from the problem, even the largest problem will look small. And then you'll understand how to take a pathway to deal with that problem. Seeing with the eye of an eagle means that you're a very good leader. Because you can get so high up in the air, you can see where roads lead, what the consequences will be for your actions. But to only see with the eye of an eagle, if that's the only pattern available to you, then you'll be in problems too. Because you literally won't have your feet on the ground. That the old people say that you will never be able to become emotionally attached to other people because you're so detached. And so that's the danger of only seeing with the eye of evil. In the story that I told you the other night, they had the buffalo in it. That the buffalo were Indian people whose tribes had access to the buffalo, not all did. The buffalo represents generosity and sharing, which is a very strong virtue for Indian people. But if that's all that you're able to do, like the buffalo that gives up every part of itself, sacrifices itself for Indian people to give them food and clothing and other things, then you literally have nothing left for yourself. You have nothing left for your own family. You've given everything of your own away. And so seeing with the eye of the buffalo means you learn to keep balance. To keep that as a virtue but not be trapped in having that as the only pattern of interaction available to you. Some of our other stories, we have characters such as Hawk. And Hawk is a warrior. talk is the one that comes with a sword, not with peace. And there are times in your life when it'll be necessary or appropriate for you to have to fight for what's yours, for what you believe in. But if that's the only set of eyes available to you, it means that every time you get into a confrontation, you will fight. That's the only choice you have available to you. And so that's part of what our traditional stories do. They're talking not so much about signs, but they're talking about symbols, patterns of interactions, of different ways in which you can understand the world. And these stories talk about not just these four, but skunk, snake. They talk about swallow, they talk about seal, they talk about snail. They talk about all these different kinds of animal people, because each one of them has something else that they can teach us as human beings. And to be a complete human being, to stand in the glory of God, means having access to all these different sets of eyes, to realize that they really are a part of you, that you have access to all those different things, if you'll only step out of the way and let it happen, that you can see with the eyes of all these different animal people and discover an interactional style that's most appropriate for you at a particular time. You can't stay in that set of eyes because eventually you go out of harmony because the tune changes. Okay? That you have to be flexible enough to be like that little girl and discover all these different patterns of interactions so that you can move back and forth between them. And this is part of what I think creativity is all about. To be able to move as a creative artist, to learn to see with all these different sets of eyes, to express yourself in all these different ways, and realize that you're not doing it for the glory of yourself, but as Ursula Gwynn says, you're doing it because you're working for the glory of God. Because what takes place is that you have this wonderful harmony in a way that you, particularly those of you with Lutheran background, and appreciate what music is all about. And we're really talking about not the music that you sing at Vespers, but the music of the spheres, the music of life itself. And understanding that music as your part in it is a very frightening thing, but it's a very special thing too. Another friend of mine, Ursula Gwynn, in one of her books talks about the idea that it isn't a simple thing, as the young men think, that you pick up a stone, and that's the end of it, you throw it. That when you pick up the stone, the world changes, that the earth is lighter and the hand is heavier. And that when you throw, you start a chain of actions for which you'll never see it again. That the stone thrown into the water ripples out, and you never know exactly where those ripples go. And that the animal people of the world, the gnat and the whale and the leaf, the cedar tree, the wolf, what they do in terms of understanding their interactions with life, they don't have to do with thinking. They don't have to do it with doing. They do it by being, because they're doing what is natural for them. They're being who they are. In so much as we are human beings, in so much as we have the power to reason, we've given up that sense of being so that we have to choose to interact in an appropriate way. That we have to choose how we will blend in with the harmony of the world in a way that is so natural and so much a part of the nature of the four-footed people, of the people of the air, of the plant people. Those people don't have to do, they just are. Because we're human beings, we have to do. We have to choose how we'll fit into that harmony. And that's what I wanted to share with you today. And a Krishna. Are there any questions that you have? Are there any answers that you have? Yes.
Can you explain a little bit more on the question of the
children? It depends on the individual tribes. Traditionally, what would take place is the children of the first purified. In other words, they would fast, as people were doing earlier this week. That they would be in prayer a great deal. That the people who are holy people or medicine people would work with them in terms of staying with them to get them prepared, to get them to the point where they were ready to accept that purified and their guardianship. Now, not all children who are sent out receive a guardian angel. Sometimes they have to go out several times until they weren't really ready for that experience. And there are some children who may receive it much earlier, children who are 8 or 9 years old, because they're ready. And this is one of the things that, as an educator, I get upset with, because we have gone to believing it literally, and the word is can't be a sham. It's unfortunate because Piaget's information is good, but it's corrupted by educators. And Piaget was a Swiss psychologist who worked with the idea that children go through different stages of development. And unfortunately, what took place is that people believe it literally. It's true that children go through different stages of development, but not every child goes through exactly the same stages at the same time as other children. And what we do in our educational system is do elementary school and middle school and high school with the idea that all children who are in 10th grade should behave in a certain way and all children who are in 4th grade should behave in a certain way. And as we know from our experience traditionally, there are some children who are developmentally ready to do something at a very early age and some children will not be able to do that same task until much later. And it doesn't mean one is stupid, the other one is smart, it just means that they're developing at different times. And so there are some children who will develop much earlier than others who are already at the age Now, when a child is sent out, they are usually sent to a place that we consider to be a place of power, often on a mountain or by a river, and they will spend maybe 4 days, 5 days, depends on the tribe, waiting, where they pray, they meditate, they leave themselves open for the spirit to come. A medicine person, a holy person, be monitoring them. Make sure that nothing is taking place that's negative or wrong for them. Check in with them periodically to come and visit them to answer questions that they might have. But it's really a time where they internally explore themselves, who they are, and what their place is in the world. Now, one of the sad things that took place is that with the coming of non-Indian people, a lot of the places which were traditionally sacred areas are now shopping centers, are now parking lots, were bought up by non-Indian people who put up non-trespassing signs. And so for a number of the tribes, what takes place now is that they will take the log houses, or the smoke houses, which is sometimes called the Western Washington, and they will partition off part of it, and they call these the coops, and they make blanket separation, using blankets and make partitions. And they will put the children in here because we know that we can at least spiritually purify this area. And a lot of places that were spiritually pure before, places of power, have been corrupted and polluted spiritually. And so we can lose control of this small area. So nowadays, when a lot of the young people go through their vision quest, it's into the log house itself rather than to the outside to receive this
message.
What is
the time before the power?
There's certainly a sense of feeling in those places. It was also traditional that over generations, these were the areas where people went. I think also a sense of isolation. There's the belief among a lot of the people that the very presence of man is something of a spiritual pollutant. And that's why you have to purify yourself and fast and go through all these purification rituals before you're ready to go to those places of power. And so a lot of the places that were chosen were somewhat isolated places where a casual person would not be strolling by. And so that would be mountaintops, that would be certain places by rivers, by whirlpools, those kinds of places of power. I would suspect the wilderness where Christ went was a place of power too. Anybody else? Yes. I think that Native American religion had some overtones of Eastern, but I think there are also some differences. if I have to do gross generalizations, and you understand, of course, that generalizations are a form of lying. But sometimes if you pretend the generalizations are true, they'll work out for you. That I would say that one of the difficulties that Christian religion has traditionally had for a lot of people, particularly the way it was practiced in the United States, was the idea that your focus should really be on heaven. Yes. And so that earth down here is something you kind of endure. And that you can suffer the injustices, that you can take on all these awful things because you know that this is merely like the waiting room. And that once your name is called, then you go up here where everything is wonderful. With Eastern religions, there's the idea that you have earth here that you have to let go in terms of achieving nirvana, a place with no wind, those sorts of things, where you kind of disperse and you blend back into the world itself, the true world, not the Maya world, but the true world. And so that you become in harmony with everything else, and you lose your individuality and blend in with totality. With Indian people, it's a circle. Okay? So that you have to go out into the wilderness and receive your guardian spirit power so that you learn about who you are as an individual. In the process of doing that, you learn the connection you have with everything around you. And that's part of the process that you go through when you receive your guardian spirit. The people who undergo that process talk about during that moment when they bond, they experience that totality that's described oftentimes in nirvana. The idea that you're in contact with every living thing outside of you, all the things that surround you. But you don't end there. And that was the point of the story of the young girl with the basket naked. That after you've had that experience, then you return to the earth, which is heaven. And you work with the people around you so that you're very much in contact with that earth. So that you go back and forth in dynamic tension between achieving that unity and then coming out and being separate again. And I think that's a little bit of the difference between those two other experiences. So thank you all very much and have a lovely life. Go create something.